Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Zika epidemic that is out of control in Puerto Rico and has now landed in an American city, Miami, with many infected by local mosquitoes now carrying the virus. Dr. Susan Wood, a former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health, who is the Executive Director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services, joins us to discuss how Zika has been a public health crisis in South America and the Caribbean, and its spread to Puerto Rico and Miami has been anticipated, but preventative action has been stymied by the Congress. Since the Republican House put riders on the compromised Senate funding bill to defund Planned Parenthood, the Clean Water Act, and protect the Confederate flag, we will look into whether pregnant women in Puerto Rico and now Miami will be holding the Congress responsible for their anxiety over giving birth to a child with microcephaly. And, by extension, will the feckless Democrats hold the Republicans responsible for endangering American women to protect the Confederate flag? Then we'll examine the charter school racket that was exposed by John Oliver on his HBO comedy show, which raises the question on whether some of the best investigative journalism nowadays is being done by comedians. Joining us is Diane Ravitch, who served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George W. Bush, then made a radical break with his policies like No Child Left Behind, which she wrote about in The Death and Life of the Great American School System, and in her latest book, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. We'll discuss how, instead of investing in our students, America's kids have become profit centers for scam artists as public schools are defunded to serve the whims of egotistical billionaires experimenting with the future of America's students, whose future they're meddling is diminishing. Then finally, we'll analyze the impact of the media's convention of false equivalency that allows Donald Trump to get away with calling Hillary Clinton a bigot without providing any factual evidence compared to her speech about the alt-right that documented Trump's many racist remarks and the extent to which the white nationalist movement in this country has flocked to his banner. On top of which, Trump recently appeared on stage with the racist head of UKIP and hired the head of Breitbart Media, which claims to be the platform for the alt-right, as his campaign chief. Brian Levin, the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, who served as the Associate Director of Legal Affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center, joins us to discuss how the press is helping Trump muddy the waters as to who is the racist running for president. And joining us now is Dr. Susan Wood, who's a former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health. She is Associate Professor of Health Policy and of Environmental and Occupational Health and the Executive Director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Susan Wood.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And thank you for joining us, Dr. Wood. And the president on his weekend address was quite passionate and is pretty worked up about the fact that we already have an outbreak of Zika here in the United States that's not imported from those who've been infected in either the Caribbean or South or Central America, but rather from mosquitoes in the United States, which in itself is a pretty alarming prospect. He basically, said that because of the delay in Zika funding, Congress is putting Americans at risk. And do you think? I know you're a health specialist as opposed to a political scientist, but on the other hand, it's inescapably become a political issue. Do you think the president can shame the Congress into action on this?
I mean, I don't know. The president is absolutely right to be outraged about the lack of action or the lack of support for the action of the administration to both prevent Zika from getting a foothold here in the United States in our population and putting all of us at risk, and particularly unborn children and future children. He's absolutely right to be outraged. We should be doing more, and there's so many different strategies that need to be tackled, from you know, mosquito control all the way through to contraception, and we need to have to developing a vaccine. All of these things have to be done quickly. It's urgent. It is time sensitive, and the fact that that we've been wasting time is indeed an outrage. So whether or not Congress can be pushed to do its responsibility in providing funding for this emergency, I don't know. It's been a challenge for many years for anything that President Obama seeks to do, the Congress, the Republican leadership in Congress objects to. So unfortunately, they're letting that kind of political knee-jerk response take over on an issue of great public health priority and urgency.
But I think if you put yourself in the position of a pregnant woman in Miami, Florida, who's either been exposed and is suffering the anxiety of having a child with microcephaly, which will be a lifetime, if the child survives very long, will be a massively expensive and a painful experience for both mother and child. And those that want to get pregnant or you know, just the idea that a mosquito, and by the way, this Aegis aegypti mosquito is human-centric. I mean, it feeds off humans. That's what its target is. It's called the cockroach mosquito. So it's essentially, you've got Americans, citizens and voters living in a terrible state of anxiety. And I think anybody with any empathy should be outraged, surely. I mean, do you think it's because it's not quite, it's in our backyard, but not quite in our front yard yet?
I mean, I think that's part of it. Certainly, we don't always recognize risks that are coming until they're upon us. And I think that's the responsibility of the leaders of the country, and certainly it's been the responsibility of those who are expert to inform the political leadership so that they can respond as needed. And I think that information is out there. I mean, I grew up in Florida, so I am well aware of those mosquitoes and how prevalent they are and how it is so difficult to stay away from them during mosquito season. And there really is no good reason. But the American public is not, the role of government when it's doing its job is to help people protect themselves from those things that are usually beyond an individual's control. And so here is a case where it has been clear for many months that this was going to put our nation at risk, and not just in a theoretical way, but in a way, as you said, which will directly impact individual families who may experience a pregnancy with a terrible and tragic outcome. And we have seen this coming. It is not a surprise, and we have the tools at hand to be able to really, maybe not 100%, but to really move towards protection, getting a vaccine, getting that research going and getting it going fast and being able to maintain it, not run out of money when we might be able to get a vaccine, to be able to provide contraception to all those women, particularly in the southern states who are most at risk from this mosquito and the virus it may carry, to make sure that the mosquito control and nets and spraying and states have the ability to track and screen all of the people who might be at risk. We have counts, and CDC now has counts on who we have documented have Zika, but there may well be far more because we're not actually screening everyone who may have this virus. It doesn't come with symptoms all the time. Sometimes it does, but most people don't have symptoms. So how we really don't have a grasp on this, and we need to have people out there in the states monitoring this much more closely than they can do, because right now, frankly, there aren't the resources available because Congress is not providing those funds to the states, to the research community, to the prevention community, to the family planning community to be able to really so that individuals can have the tools they need to be protected.
And, of course, the blood supply is now going to be screened for Zika.
Right.
And, again, I'm speaking with Dr. Susan Wood, who's a former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health. She's Associate Professor of Health Policy and of Environmental and Occupational Health and the Executive Director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. So there's
another... And I will note that there, you say that, you know, we haven't been able to force Congress to do anything. I think there's been a lot of people standing up and saying this must be done, starting with the president, but also Secretary Clinton has made it a key part of her platform, just announcing an initiative to have an emergency response prevention fund that would be ready to go on a dime when something like this happened. We need to have this discussed in the campaign more. It needs to be asked of the candidates. Said Secretary Clinton certainly has the understanding and the will to do something, similar to President Obama. But we need to challenge them and bring this up so that there is outrage from the public and it transmits itself into reality.
Well, I sort of brought that up in the introduction as a rhetorical question. I'm sort of stunned that the Democrats are so flat-footed in this election year that they haven't been able to make an issue out of this and to shame the Republicans, because there's so much hypocrisy in this. To begin with, most of the states, in fact, in the South that will be affected by the spread of Zika. It's already in Florida, but it's will probably will certainly move to Alabama, Mississippi, Texas, etc., all of which are red states, represented by the very congresspeople who put on these riders about protecting the Confederate flag and defunding Planned Parenthood and defunding the Clean Water Act, which the Democrats could not sign on to, and thus they all went off on vacation and left Obama trying to figure out how to deal with this crisis by shifting funds from the Ebola appropriations. And as the president pointed out in his address over the weekend, that they're running out very quickly. They run out within a matter of a week. So this is the situation. The other part of it that I find immensely hypocritical is that many of these Republican congressmen are obsessed with the abortion issue, the so-called right to life. Well, a pregnant woman afraid of Zika, isn't that possibly one of the more powerful examples of the right to life and protection of the unborn?
Well, there's often this hypocrisy that comes that, you know, we care about the unborn, but we leave them on their own once they are born. And in this case, unfortunately, we don't know what we will see in the United States in 6 to 9 months, and hopefully we won't see this large rise in babies born with microcephaly. But certainly women are rightfully worried if they are pregnant and in those zones across the southern tier and where the mosquitoes are most rampant and the virus is starting to spread in South Florida and perhaps moving over along the Gulf states to Texas. We certainly hope that this doesn't occur, but this is a case when actually a truly pro-life person would be pushing for access to better family planning services and access to comprehensive education so that we can prevent all the unintended pregnancies that we know happen. 50% of our pregnancies, in fact, are unintended. And so we need to have more access, and yet to say we're going to cut off Planned Parenthood, one of the major providers of contraceptive services in the nation, is absolutely contradictory to what is clearly needed, you know, now and moving forward in order to prevent the devastating effects of Zika and on those, you know, unintended pregnancies. And for those women who do plan to get pregnant and are pregnant, and they need to be able to have the protections that they need and the support that they need in order to have a healthy pregnancy and a healthy child. And we're not seeing that kind of support at all, unfortunately, from indeed the leadership of those states that are most likely to be affected. It's there's only, it's the nature of our divided government and the partisanship. But in this case, it's not just, no, he said, she said, or one party says this and another party says that. This is a matter of clear and urgent public health need and a very high-risk situation. And this isn't about politics. This is about, you know, health and, you know, devastating birth defects. And to trivialize it by just saying it's partisan to raise the topic, it is not. It is good government. It is good leadership. It is the right thing to be doing. It is the moral and ethical thing to be doing. It has really nothing to do with politics to raise it and to challenge the blockage of these resources. And I've seen Senator Clinton is doing that. President Obama is doing that. They are not politicizing it. They are raising up the issues that the American people should be highly supportive of.
Well, presumably the American people, as it becomes more and more apparent that this Zika epidemic has spread to the United States, and there are already travel warnings about going to Miami. That kind of awareness, I guess, will eventually create a kind of political outrage. But, of course, Puerto Rico already has a pretty much out-of-control epidemic there, and I guess because it's not Puerto Ricans don't have all the rights that American citizens have, including voting for president.
This is sort of, you know, it's human nature. We're not going to see the consequences of this. This is not a disease that makes you, or a virus that makes you instantly ill. It's a virus that you don't see the consequences till about 9 months later. Or 6 to 9 months later. And that is, when and if those consequences start to arise in Puerto Rico, in other parts of the U.S., it's hard to sort of feel like you have to be doing something until the consequence arrives. And unfortunately, these consequences are so serious. We need to be ahead of the curve. And sadly, we are not ahead of the curve, and we are actually behind the curve. And it may take until those consequences start showing up before some of the political people in Congress who have been blocking this start to see the light.
Well, already there are, 1,301 mosquito-borne cases recorded in the United States, 97% of which are in Puerto Rico, and where there are 1,259 recorded cases on the island. Although some health officials with the CDC believe the true number may be more than 80,000. So
right. I mean, we don't know what the true numbers are. We know that it's not just mosquito-borne. It's people coming with mosquito-borne disease from traveling, but then they may transmit it either sexually, and this blood transfusion guidance from the FDA is a way to try and prevent it from being a blood transfusion-borne disease. But there's more than one pathway to be infected. We have millions of births in the United States every year, and this is, you know, a clear and present danger. And we have to we don't know the total numbers because we're not screening everyone who needs to be screened. The symptoms are not serious, or they may not even be present in the majority of people with the virus, and it can be transmitted through many other ways or several other ways besides mosquito. And we really need to be getting on top of this months ago, much less today, or even more so today.
Well, Dr. Susan Wood, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's an important topic.
Well, thanks for the information you provided us. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Susan Wood, who's a former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health. She's Associate Professor of Health Policy and of Environmental and Occupational Health and the Executive Director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back speaking with Diane Ravitch about the charter school racket. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the charter school racket with Diane Ravitch. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Diane Ravitch, who's a professor in New York University's Steinhardt School of Education and one of America's best-known education experts. She served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush and established a reputation as a conservative champion of school choice, testing standards, No Child Left Behind, and other programs claiming to make schools more efficient and effective. In her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Ravitch explains how she came to make a radical break with those policies. And her most recent book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Welcome to Background Briefing, Diane Ravitch.
Thank you, Ian, for inviting me.
And Diane, it seems to me that we're in a strange situation with journalism in the United States, in as much as it takes a comedian like John Oliver on HBO to do a really an amazing investigative journalism piece on the effects of these charter schools and the privatization movement in general, which, of course, charter schools is a huge part of. What did you think of the John Oliver piece?
Well, I thought it was outstanding because it's been so hard to get any coverage from the national media about the scams, the frauds, the grifters, the graft, all of this that's going on in the charter sector. And the problem with the charter sector is it's become the charter industry, and it's being backed by billionaires. It's being backed by Wall Street. It's being backed by the Gates Foundation, the Eli Broad Foundation, and they're promoting the privatization of American education. Now, John Oliver didn't focus on the privatization angle, but all of that, the trouble he described is what is a natural consequence of deregulation. When you have deregulation and when you have a lack of oversight, as you do, for instance, in California, then you get fraud because people have opportunity and motive to steal or to do things that they shouldn't do. So this is really privatization equal and deregulation go hand in hand and produce fraud and graft.
Well, we've spoken before about the for-profit college racket, which is about between $30 and $40 billion of taxpayers' money is going into for-profit colleges, most of which are essentially indenturing the students for life with burdensome debt. And they use the taxpayer money to advertise enormously. They bring in lots of veterans on the new GI Bill, and essentially give these kids worthless diplomas and saddle them with a lifetime of debt. It is cruel and unusual punishment. I mean, we are living in a society now where instead of investing in students as our future, the future of our country, students are being seen as profit centers, not investment centers.
Well, unfortunately, there is this for-profit industry, and it's not only in higher education, but it's now in K-12 education, and we now have a significant number of charter schools run for profit, and even some that are non-profit, as John Oliver pointed out, are being run by for-profit management organizations. So the fraud is spreading. I mean, the higher education fraud is an outrage, and what makes it particularly awful is that it's being subsidized by the taxpayers. The federal government has to pay these colleges, and they pay a huge amount to the for-profits. They make a lot of money. Although Corinthian colleges went under and stranded hundreds of thousands of students, it's really a disgrace. And personally, I don't think that any for-profit college or any for-profit school should receive any taxpayer money. That would be a good start. But I think as far as the nonprofit schools and the K-12 sector, I think they should belong to the public sector. I mean, we have public education is a guaranteed right in this country. You don't have the government can't allow kids to go uneducated, but we shouldn't be calling a private organization a public school. It is not a public school when it doesn't have democratic control, it doesn't have regular auditing, it doesn't have transparency, it doesn't have accountability.
Well, it would seem that all you have to do is sort of hang up a shingle. You don't have to have any background. One of the more egregious ones was a school that was a nightclub during the evenings and an alleged school during the day. They can lie about their numbers and they get paid for students that don't exist. And in order to get around auditing, all they have to do is essentially subcontract it out to some fictitious entity. So
this is happening all over the country, Ian. There are now, I think, 40 or 45 states that permit charter schools, and some of them have virtually no supervision and very, very low requirements as to who can open a school. In some states, schools have been opened by people who have shady backgrounds. Many schools have been opened by businessmen who are not educators, who just want to make money and have made a lot of money. And there have been scandals in almost every state. California has had many, many scandals with its charter schools because the State Department of Education can't possibly supervise more than 1,000 separate schools. That's the job of the school districts, but these schools are not supervised by school districts. So there's a lot of fraud that goes on, and these schools also keep out kids with severe disabilities. They also push out kids who are English language learners, and they rig up their scores by pushing out the low-scoring kids. So it's really a sham. It's creating an incentive for people to look at education not as a public good but as a marketplace. And education is not a business. And I know there's one charter school in California that has as its motto, education is our business. No, education is not a business. Education is a public responsibility, and it's about developing children to their fullest. And there shouldn't be a profit motive involved at any point in the process.
And again, I'm speaking with Diane Ravitch, who's a professor in New York University Steinhardt School of Education and one of America's best-known education experts. She served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush, and in her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Ravitch explains how she came to a radical break with the policies of the George Bush administration, including No Child Left Behind. Her most recent book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. But the bottom line here, though, is that money that goes, public money from taxpayers, that goes to charter schools is money that would otherwise go to public schools. And one of the country's most troubled public school systems is in Detroit. And that's where Eli Broad comes from, or Broad. I keep getting his name wrong.
Broad.
For some reason or other, he has some pretentious-sounding name. But he's, of course, idolized here in the Los Angeles community by the art world as a philanthropist. But I'm not sure that his reputation is so well-deserved, given the wreckage that he's left behind in Detroit, his former hometown, where he decided to push this charter school initiative. That was the sort of petri dish of this catastrophe.
Well, the New York Times had an article about 2 weeks ago about Detroit, and it said it's a city awash in charter schools and choice, but there are no good choices. They have many, many charter schools. They're performing poorly. They have many public schools that are performing poorly. No one is performing well because there's no plan in place. The idea of choice is ridiculous because what choice really does is divert attention from the public responsibility. So instead of having a public system that can be scrutinized and worked on and improved, where classes can be reduced, where kids can get attention, all these people like Eli Broad offer is choice. And choices doesn't cure anything. If you're given many bad choices, there's no choice at all. And it's a substitute for doing what should be done, which is really to make sure that the staff is well qualified, that there are experienced teachers, that there's early childhood education for all children, and that there are some very serious efforts to improve the lives of the people who live in the community, particularly with medical clinics and so forth, that are easily accessible to parents and children. But that's the thing that should be done. And Eli Broad, hopefully he can maintain his reputation in the art world. He built a wonderful museum. But in the education world, his name is mud.
Well, there is a tendency, I think, in the business world to essentially look upon politicians as hirelings, and business people, who, particularly those who make lots of money, like Eli Broad did out of building homes, in suburban homes largely, with KB Homes. You know, when you make a ton of money, I think you assume that you're incredibly clever, and the politicians are your hirelings, so you don't want to hire politicians who are smarter than you. So in many ways, I think the reason we have such dreadful politicians is because the businessman, because after all, you know, most of our politicians are telemarketers who spend most of their days dialing for dollars, largely from wealthy businessmen and, you know, wealthy oligarchs, if you don't mind the term. So go ahead. Sorry.
Ian, there's a kind of a not a virtuous circle, but an unvirtuous circle here, which is the politicians all need money to run. They turn to people like Eli Broad and to a bunch of other billionaires or hedge fund managers. And then the hedge fund managers and the billionaires say, well, if you want my support, you've got to help us privatize public education because the schools are failing and therefore they need to fail more so that we can then open up charter schools. Now, Eli Broad doesn't have a profit motive. He just happens to believe that the free market solves all problems. But in fact, in education, we know that what the free market does is to magnify problems. The charters skim off the kids they want, push out the kids they don't want, and charters and choice and vouchers produce more segregation and don't solve any problems. They just make the problems worse, and they're a pretend form of social action. The real social action would be for Eli Broad to be fighting to raise taxes on billionaires so that there would be more money available for health care for children and universal pre-K. But I was very happy that John Oliver did his show, but I hope that he does another show exposing the people who are putting the money into this and the politicians who are fighting for it, as well as the fact that this whole charter movement comes from the far, far right, which people like Eli Broad and Bill Gates usually don't like to be associated with. It comes from a very shadowy group called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which pushes a corporate agenda of deregulation and free markets in every sector. And they want to get rid of public schools. And it has been a source of great frustration to me that the media has not paid attention to what I consider to be one of the greatest scandals of our time, which is this secret movement or this hidden movement with dark money to privatize public education. The public has never been asked their opinion. They've never taken a vote. Whenever they voted on vouchers, they voted it down. Massachusetts is going to have a ballot issue in November on charters, and I'm predicting they'll vote it down because the public has never approved privatization.
Well, but is this really all about ego? If you've made billions of dollars, therefore you're a billion times smarter than everybody else, including your political hirelings who you get to do your bidding because they ask you for money. Is this, for example, if Bill Gates and particularly Eli Broad are smart bottom-line businessmen, the evidence is out there that their experiment is not working. Is there any evidence that they're getting the message?
Well, I know of no evidence they're getting the message, but I think you're absolutely right that what's driving them is ego, and not greed, but ego, in the sense that they know how to solve the problems of any sector because they're billionaires. And being so rich, they think they're very smart about everything. Now, Bill Gates started this about 15 years ago, saying that small high schools were the answer to everything. Well, small high schools are a good idea, but he abandoned that in 2008 and said, well, I spent $2 billion on that. It didn't work. I'm moving on. He moved on to charters. He moved on to the goofy idea that you could evaluate teachers by looking at the test scores of their students. And so he's still pushing that agenda. And he so far is batting 0-for-0 in education. But the last message out from his foundation was, we failed up till now, but we're going to double down on our efforts. Now, I don't know what reasonable businessman would say, no one wants my product, but we're going to produce twice as many of them.
Well, apart from the arrogance of these plutocrats who think they're smarter than everybody else and are imposing their egotistical and somewhat, I mean, you know, it's sort of almost capricious and whimsical. It's almost like education has become a kind of plaything. Mm-hmm. Our children are suffering from it. So the other part of it, though, that really is infuriating is that, as is the case with the for-profit colleges that soak up between $30 and $40 billion of taxpayers' money and have outrageous and destructive results, all of that money is taxpayer money. And so is in the case of the charter schools. And you have this illusion that the free market is operating. This is right-wing welfare. This is corporate welfare in its most pernicious and despicable manifestation.
Absolutely. I'm going to send you an article about about the for-profit higher education. They have bought up lobbyists from both parties in Washington, D.C., and so they have been able to escape the kind of regulation that should exist. I think that for-profit colleges is an oxymoron. But the same thing is happening in K-12. There are corporations running, even in California. It's a corporation called K-12, created by Michael Milken, and it's a huge profit generator. It's online charter schools, and the kids sign in for maybe an hour a day. They may be watching pornography, but they've signed in. And the company is picking up full tuition for them, and the research is that they're abysmal schools. The kids aren't learning anything. So that's definitely an example where the market is not serving the needs of the children. It's actually scamming the taxpayers, and it's not regulated. California has enough evidence now to shut that school down, but it's under three different investigations, and nothing has happened so far.
So, but at the end of the day, aren't we heading in a direction? If you are essentially turning our students into profit centers and instead of investment centers, and you're just scamming the taxpayer in the name of free enterprise, you're basically being subsidized in a socialist subsidy with capitalist profit, I guess, and this has become the plaything of billionaires. At the end of the day, won't we turn this country, into, the land of Donald Trump's? One of the problems we have with Donald Trump running for president is that we shouldn't have somebody like that running for president. And the only reason we do is that the people who support him are not particularly well
educated. It's really a testament to the fact that, I'd say, for 15 years we focused only on testing low-level skills of reading and math. And I suspect if more people understood civics and history, they would be able to see through the nonsense he spews and the lies that he spews. And he says one thing one day and contradicts it the second day and then says the third thing the third day. And critical thinking is lacking. And I don't blame that on the schools, but I do think that the media should be all over what's happening in education and why are we not focused on really higher level skills and really preparing our kids for citizenship. And you have to kind of go back to the original question. The original question is, why do we have public schools? Well, I'm a historian of education. We have public schools to prepare citizens for the future, not to get them ready for college or careers, but to become citizens. To become citizens, you have to be able to think, you have to have knowledge, and you have to have a sense of responsibility and ethics. I think the current situation, we're not doing that. We're just churning out money to help all kinds of profiteers make dough on the schools, on the colleges, and specifically on kids. And we got to change that. That's what I'm working on. And I would urge readers to, your listeners, to take a look at my blog where I write about this every single day, DianeRavitch.net. I've had close to 28 million page views, and I keep after both higher education and K-12 education.
DianeRavitch.net. Well, just in closing, I brought up Donald Trump because he did say that I love the poorly educated voters.
Yes. And he wants more of them, I assume.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That, we have a choice, essentially, whether we are passive consumers or active citizens. And it seems to me that the people in power in this country, the oligarchy, for want of a better description, seem to be heading in a direction where they want us to be passive consumers and not active citizens. And that is a path to an idiocracy and the end of America as we know it. So there's a lot more at stake here, I think, than just playing a couple of billionaires playing around with education.
Well, we've got to stop it now. But thank you very much for calling, Ian. It's been great to talk with you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Diane Ravitch, who's a professor in New York University Steinhardt School of Education and one of America's best known education experts. She served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. And in her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Ravitch explains how she came to make a radical break with the policies of George W. Bush, including No Child Left Behind. And her most recent book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back analyzing the impact of the media's convention of false equivalency that allows Donald Trump to get away with calling Hillary Clinton a bigot.
Your destination, college town. La, 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 la. The Southern University system. La, 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 la.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of legal affairs at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and he recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
As always, thank you so much, Ian. It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Brian. And this political race between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton seems to be now focused on who is a racist. And the extraordinary thing about our media, because of its false equivalence, this slavish idea that you have to say on the one hand and on the other hand, and that there are two truths in the entire universe of discourse. This has led to Hillary Clinton delivering a speech that was very well documented, well sourced, about Donald Trump's manifest and clear and real connections to right-wing extremism and his own examples of his own racist outbursts in public, all of which are documented. And yet all he had to do to preempt the speech was to say Hillary Clinton is a bigot and he gets equal time. And frankly, it's infuriating. But do you think that it works? Is there enough people that believe that Hillary Clinton is a bigot, or just the mere fact that he's muddying the water inhibits her message?
You know, here's the thing. We're only in the fourth inning. And, you know, I was on KCAL 9 with, you know, another Southern California journalistic legend, Dave Bryan. And he made an excellent point. See what happens in the next inning, because we have debates coming up. And I think if she gets up on that podium and says, American Renaissance Storm, former Ku Klux Klansman, David Duke, the Traditionalist Workers' Party, the Loyal White Knights, and just reads this, like, ubiquitous list of the most horrendous hate mongers in the United States and say that they have near unanimity in their support for you, how do you explain that, sir? I think that's going to be an interesting period in that debate. So I think for the shorthand, he returned the volley as best as someone could without being responsive to the actual charges. But nevertheless, I think for the independent voters and others who are worried about his temperament are also going to worry about this connection to the alt-right and this Euro-nationalism. If I could make just one last point before moving on, and that is there are a lot of people in this country who feel that they're disenfranchised and feel that global affairs and the changing demographics and economy of this country is leaving them behind. And they have a very understandable anxiety and fear. The problem is we don't need to channel it into a combustible Euro-nationalist forum, of which the alt-right and the hard-line hate-mongers are using as an avenue to get into the mainstream. That is the disturbing byproduct of this wildfire. Donald Trump, whether or not people believe he's a racist or not, is happy to go into the barn and kick that canister of gasoline over, and whether he walks away or becomes president, is still going to leave these hate-mongers in a position that they weren't before. Number one, with a charismatic spokesperson who is singing their tune, using their sheet music, even if they don't fully get into the arena. And number two, is making them a mainstream political force to be reckoned with. And that is a terrible thing.
Well, already Spencer and these other right-wing white nationalists are celebrating their moment of glory and the focus that Hillary Clinton has put on them. But when you say, Brian Levin, that in a debate, Hillary Clinton, who has the ammunition of facts, can challenge him about who he is and who supports him, all he has to do is just make anything up. It doesn't matter. And that's the part that bothers me. She can make a very cogent case, and then he can just suddenly say, you're a member of the Ku Klux Klan. I have proof that you're a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And he almost did that. He said because she apparently eulogized Senator Byrd and called him a mentor, and Senator Byrd was previously a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and obviously made a journey away from them. But nevertheless, that sort of haunts him. So suddenly, because she eulogized Senator Byrd as somebody who was a mentor to her, being the senior senator when she was a junior senator, suddenly Hillary Clinton's a member of the Ku Klux Klan. So that's what you're up against here.
And you make an excellent point, along with President Harry Truman, who was for the Ku Klux Klan, and Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black, who went on to become just a legendary and iconic libertarian. The issue, and let me address two things. One is, at least these folks repudiated their Klan membership from early in life. It's not like Hillary Clinton is getting endorsed generally by people who are in the Klan today, or that she asks for their support, or tries to in some way pivot, change the topics and say, I don't know who David Duke is, or something like that. But look, I think you're right, and I think you hit on an excellent point, and that is, unfortunately, not everyone's listening to the Ian Masters show. There are people who are wedded to conspiracy theories. So it's no accident that one of the chief purveyors of birtherism is now running for president and making all kinds of factually inaccurate or downright untrue statements. The bottom line, though, I think for Trump's 30-some-odd percent that support him, it's not going to make a difference. But I do think that there are independents, and particularly in swing states, and even some in communities that he's supposedly trying to reach out to, the Latino and African-American community, who are just not going to buy it. And the fact is, I think that's where the difference will be made. It's in those people whose support for Secretary Clinton may be soft, or even those whose support for Donald Trump may be soft, or who are independents and who don't subscribe to this echo chamber. But I think you're right. And one of the excellent points that you made is we now have a mainstream political party who doesn't just have bigots showing up at the door, but they're now in the House. And how they respond to this, the party of Lincoln, a party that, you know, for all the political disagreements, I've dealt with both sides of the aisle and been invited to testify before Congress from both sides of the aisle. We had policy discussions. Now, some of these policies might have very well disproportionately affected communities of color, but there are many conservative people of goodwill who certainly are not bigots, who must be terrified as to the developments that Donald Trump is bringing to the party, which was once about policy and also against conspiracy theories. This is a terrible time for the party of Lincoln.
And again, I'm speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of legal affairs at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and he recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security and Subcommittee on Terrorism and intelligence. But just to buttress this critique of the binary nature of this false equivalence that we have in our press because of this slavish adoption of, on the one hand, on the other hand, the Democrat position, then the Republican position, these are the examples I would give of just recent headlines about this business over Hillary Clinton's speech about the alt-right and Donald Trump's accusations that she's a bigot. The headline in the Washington Post, Clinton-Trump exchange racially charged accusations. That doesn't tell you a damn thing, except they're both slinging mud at each other. Trump and, this is from Politico, Trump and Clinton throw more blows in bigotry fight. Again, the false equivalence, that they're both sort of in the mud together, when she actually has a fact-based case about him, which the evidence for which is manifest. You can, there's endless clips of him on video saying the most outrageous things, and there's endless clips of his supporters on the far right talking about how great he is. And I think, by the way, I think there's a considerable amount of evidence that Donald Trump is a racist. I mean, he apparently, when he visited his casinos in New Jersey, all of the black employees were told to get into the back rooms. He's on the record saying, I don't want black people counting my money. I only want guys in yarmulkes counting my money. We know about him and his father's racism in not allowing people of color to rent from them, etc. So would you, as somebody that's had a career in documenting the activities and statements of the far right in this country, would you characterize Donald Trump as a racist?
Well, you know, our center is nonpartisan. So by a matter of policy, we direct our discussions to particular issues and policies rather than people. But let me say this. I wouldn't want to defend the contra side of that argument. but the bottom line is that that's a decision that voters will make from the evidence. And I think if someone is not a racist, then it is incumbent upon them to repudiate every manifestation of hate group support, as Ronald Reagan did, and as many other Republican candidates have done. And what is so sad, if you look at some of the statements of people who are, you know, Republican symbols and leaders, John McCain, Bob Dole, even Pat Buchanan, when he was running for president, when his national campaign co-chair was exposed as being on stage with the head of Aryan Nations, even though he wasn't a bigot, that is the campaign co-chair, he was out practically the next day. And what has been disturbing is that whether or not Mr. Trump is a racist, and I'll leave that to you and your listeners to make that determination, because our center is nonpartisan and we don't endorse or repudiate candidates per se. But what is disturbing is, irrespective of whether he's just a celebrity, I know what I'm saying is he might just be saying anything to get publicity and to get elected. We'll see. I think that people can have opinions one way or the other. But the problem is, his process for doing so has elevated conspiracy theories, has elevated Euro-nationalism, and has taken the most hardened, hardcore part of the alt-right. The alt-right is not a totally racist entity, but it is severely tainted by it, and made them a mainstream political force. And that is one of the most horrendous byproducts of this political season. We're coming out with a report next week about hate crimes across the United States, and it's disturbing.
Well, but he has put in charge of his campaign a guy, Stephen Bannon, who the head of Breitbart Media, who boasts that Breitbart Media is the platform for the alt-right. And Trump had Nigel Farage on stage with him just a week ago, and Nigel Farage is the racist leader of UKIP, who is largely responsible for the British voting their way out of the EU with the Brexit vote, which was the campaign for which was absolutely unequivocally based upon racist manufactured fears over immigrants storming into Britain and corrupting the nature of British culture.
In some way, the presence of Breitbart might be more troubling, and let me tell you why. Breitbart is not an exclusively Euro-nationalist entity like American Renaissance or Daily Stormer or even Stormfront or white supremacists like some of these, in the most hardened way. It also attacks so-called liberal and progressive hypocrisy. And sometimes they're right, by the way, when they talk about, for instance, conservative voices on campuses. But that being said, that's what makes something like Breitbart so dangerous when it becomes more aligned with these hardened folks. And what I mean is it becomes an avenue or a transmitter into the mainstream of the most horrendous forms of bigotry. Bannon is on the one point an iconoclastic firebrand who sometimes or often, but not always, dabbles into this stuff. So what it does, it puts on the platter that is presented within mainstream conservatism a kind of sugar-coated Euro-nationalism, which makes it dangerous. I think it would be exaggerating to say Bannon's a Klansman or something like that, but he is someone who takes these messages of which you spoke so articulately into the mainstream. And I think that's dangerous because he has one foot in the extreme and one foot in the mainstream and seems to be currying both.
Well, Brian Levin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It is always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Ian.
Thank you, Brian. And again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as Associate Director of Legal Affairs at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and he recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.